Welcome to episode number 9 of the First Responder Wellness Podcast, the show where we talk about wellness, mental health, leadership, and what it takes to have a wellness culture within your organization. Hi, my name's Conrad Weaver, and I'm not a first responder, but I've worked with first responders from all across the country for my documentary film, PTSD 911. My guest today is Dr. Rita Brock. Dr. Brock is the Senior Vice President for Moral Injury Recovery Programs at the Volunteers of America. She leads the organization's effort to deepen understanding about moral injury in the many populations who experience it. The center built on Volunteers of America's work, spanning more than a century of helping veterans and others who live with this emotional trauma. A noted theologian, Dr. Brock was the founding director of the Soul Repair Center at Bright Divinity School at the Texas Christian University, where she was also a research professor of theology and culture. She is co-author of Soul Repair, Recovering from Moral Injury After War, and Proverbs of Ashes, Violence, Redemptive Suffering, and Search for What Saves Us. She is a leading national expert on moral injury in combat veterans and has offered trainings for VA mental health providers, for professional chaplains, and for veterans and their families. A few years ago, Dr. Brock and her team also began working with first responders, and we'll talk about that today in our podcast. And we'll also talk about the difference between moral injury and post-traumatic stress disorder. And we learn about the things that first responders can do to help heal these moral injuries. Stay tuned for this informative and insightful conversation. Hey, I really appreciate you listening to the podcast. And if you think others would too, please subscribe and share. That helps us get the word out there to others. And if you're interested in sponsoring the show, please send me an email and tell me about your company or organization. If you're looking to spread the word about what you do in the first responder space, this show may be a great fit for you. I would love to talk with you about how we can help. Thanks again for listening. And now here's my interview with Dr. Rita Brock. Well, Dr. Rita Brock, welcome to the First Responder Wellness Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So I want to learn a little bit about how you got involved in the field, in the area of public safety to start with.
Well, it came about because I had gotten interested in moral injury in military veterans. And I'd been working on that and had developed a pretty successful evidence-based program here at Volunteers of America for veterans that that seemed to help with moral injury in veterans. And that's a new term, really. It's not all that widely understood, but I want to start by saying it's not a mental health disorder. Mm-hmm. It's an ordinary human experience that involves an affliction of conscience. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I want to dive more into that.
But I got into it through the military veteran population. And then as that work was concluding and COVID hit and we had to shut it down because it was an in-person program, we began to realize there was just going to be a lot of moral injury everywhere, especially in the first responder populations, because they were on the front lines of a war with a pandemic. And it was devastating. I remember the first year. It was when no one knew what to do about it and people were dying and in numbers that were like mass casualties all the time. And so that got me interested in, first of all, the parallels, sorry, my cat's visiting, parallels between what happens in combat even and what was happening to people in hospitals and on the streets of our cities. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got moved over into a whole new population that would be affected by moral injury.
You know, I think that's a thing that many people don't realize. And, you know, if for the general public, most people think of PTSD, you know, they think of that as, you know, it's a veteran thing. It's someone who was involved in a war, which is absolutely true. I mean, but it's, you know, having our first responders, our public safety people affected by these things, it hasn't really risen to the surface until just recently. Hopefully, you know, my film is helping to tell that story as well. So what got you interested in really working back with veterans in the moral injury issue?
It actually happened because of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And there was a point in late 2004 where public opinion turned against the Iraq war, But as late as 2008, it was grinding on. And I really felt like the peace protests and things weren't working very well. Mm. I mean, the wars were grinding on and there were mass marches in Washington, all that. And so I thought there's got to be some other way to try to get at this. And so a friend of mine and I decided to try to create a truth commission on conscience and war after seeing a film. This is how films do provoke these things. A film called Soldiers of the Conscience. And it interviewed people at Fort Jackson who were ordered to redeploy to Iraq. And about half of them went and half of them didn't. And all of them were reasoning the process through about what was the lesser evil. You could hear these moral quandaries. And two actually went to prison rather than redeploy. Two were granted conscientious objector status. And others went for various reasons, including they didn't want to desert their buddies and desert their unit and feel responsible that they should have been there and things like that. So we just thought, you know, nobody talks to the veterans. Nobody talks to who has to actually fight the wars about their impact. And so we did this Truth Commission on Conscience and War, just as now the now famous essay on moral injury by the Brett Litz team was getting published. And one of our commissioners, as we were preparing for the public hearings, had learned of this essay they were writing. And he thought everybody involved with the commission should read it. And so I found this in my file the other day when I was looking at back files, pre-publication across the top. So we got it before it was even hot off the press and sent it to everybody and said, read this. This is what the commission is all about. And so then the commission happened, 100 commissioners from just war folks to pacifists to religious to veterans themselves, all kinds of people, 100 commissioners unanimously recommended in the commission report that there be public education about moral injury because people needed to understand it. So that's how I got involved with it. And so for the last 13 years now, I've been doing public education about moral injury.
Mm-hmm. And then you started working with the first responder community here a few years ago.
Right. It's interesting because a combat veteran from Vietnam was very early in the work with me. He'd been a surgeon and a battalion surgeon. And as the pandemic started, he contacted me, said, there's going to be moral injury. We need to write something. And so we actually wrote an op-ed. I think it was published in The Hill or so. I can't remember where it was published. But we wrote an essay about the parallels between combat medicine and what was happening in the hospitals and what was going to be the result of this in relation to moral injury, the sense of failure, the sense of an identity crisis that you can't do your job. It's not, nothing's working. You can't save anybody and all of those things. And one of the things that we clicked through how all the parallels were, including nobody's trained for triage, but in this situation, people were doing triage all the time, trying to figure out who would live and who would die, which is something that they're trained to save everybody, not to let people die. Right. So all of that. And then I said, and you know what? He said, what? I said, in combat, you know, your family's home safe somewhere. You may not know what's going on with them, but you know that they're not getting shot at. But in the pandemic, people were having to sleep in hospitals or worry that they were putting their own families at risk doing this work. So that was that added layer, I think, of ambiguity and stress because you never knew if you took enough showers in it because it wasn't clear how it was transmitted. And were you better off not even seeing your family? And what did that mean? So it was really much more complicated when the enemy is in your society right next door.
Right. And wow, just remember hearing those stories from first responders who said, you know, every time the tones went off, they had to, you know, especially if it was some kind of a breathing issue, they all had to suit up and you just didn't know what you were going to face. And then, like you said, I didn't know if they're going to take it home with them and just that stress.
That too. Or that they were going to jump in their ambulance and arrive and the person ought to be dead.
Right.
I remember the rookie EMT that was the first reported suicide in early It was late April of 2020. Hmm. He'd only been on the job a few months. He used his retired police father's revolver to go to the river and shoot himself. But he'd told a friend a couple of weeks before he loved his work. And then the pandemic started and he was just so defeated. He said, "All I'm doing is moving dead bodies."
Wow. Wow.
So
for our audience, let's describe, what is moral injury?
It's what happens to a good person who hits an experience or a series of experiences that they can't make moral sense of, either because they fail to do what they believe was the right thing to do, or they fail to execute the mission they were on and feel like somehow they were responsible for harm, either by inflicting it or witnessing or failing to prevent it, or being put in a situation either by a system or an authority figure or just life circumstances where they can't do the right thing. Where they're forced to sort of choose a lesser evil because there's no good thing they can do. And when a good person hits those kind of situations, their conscience bothers them. Mm-hmm. And they may put it aside because it's a moral judgment they're making about their experience. And that judgment may come as the experience is happening, or it may come a decade or two later. You just never know when that conscience is going to start coming back and haunting you, right? So people will like work to exhaustion so the stress keeps the thoughts away, because there are terrible feelings associated with that kind of sense of moral failure, like guilt and shame, or even fury and outrage, or just defeat, despair. So to keep those are painful feelings, to keep them at bay, people will work like crazy or start drinking or do other things to distract themselves so they don't have to think about it. And they may even reach the point of deciding to quit a career they loved or taking their own life. Hmm. It can be that serious.
How is that similar or different from what's commonly known as PTSD?
Well, the symptoms for PTSD involve some things like memory loss. Because when you're terrified, when you're terrified, your fear system actually shuts your memory processing down just so you can react without having to, you know, like think about how you're going to remember. It just doesn't need you to remember. It needs you to act. And so people can actually not remember the incident very well or have holes in their memory and just, but then the memory comes back as flashbacks or nightmares sometimes. So it's in there, but it's not in there in a memory processing system so you can access it as memory. It's a reliving rather than a memory. And the reliving brings all the stress and everything involved with the event back. So you might, you can have intense fear responses and even have triggers, like in a normal situation, something just reminds you of that incident and then the whole thing floods back in. That's PTSD, and it really is your fear system out of control. Mm-hmm. And they now have four chemicals they can test in your body to diagnose it. Mm-hmm. That was a news story a couple of days ago, that they've discovered that people who have symptoms of PTSD have these four markers physically for it. So that's actually useful for a diagnosis beyond the symptoms. Mm-hmm. And so treatments involve reliving the experience until you can get a coherent memory of it, remembering it in a safe context so the fear feelings begin to subside in relation to the memory. It's often you might have phobias or be hypervigilant. Those are all PTSD, and there are really good treatments, and I'm grateful to the veteran community because a lot of those treatments were developed to counsel veterans and help veterans. That is not moral injury. Moral injury is you have a memory and it's not feeling good to have it. You have a memory that creates a moral judgment about the sequence of events. And you may have a memory of something and have moral injury without any symptoms of PTSD. Mm-hmm. So they're not the same, but often they do overlap because a lot of the kind of things that challenge us morally are also in situations of terror or where harm is fierce. And so your fear system is activated. That's certainly true in things like combat where people are shooting at you. Mm-hmm. But the military trains people for that. So it's actually less common in veterans than even like civilians in a terrible car accident or things like that. So they're similar because they overlap, but they're not the same thing. And what helps with PTSD can actually lead to worse moral injury. So if you finally get a coherent memory of a thing you couldn't remember very well, you may realize, oh my God, I'm the reason that person died. Mm-hmm. And you didn't quite have that clear before. So this is why I think it's also important for mental health professionals to know something about moral injury, even if they're not going to treat it, to be on the lookout if they're treating, especially for something like PTSD, to see if the person is beginning to express value judgments or a sense of worthlessness or a sense of like, I don't know who I am anymore that I could do that. Those are moral injury statements. Or how could God have let that happen? That's a moral injury comment. That is not a mental health problem. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's a really interesting protocol that some clinicians in San Francisco developed that is what they call impact of killing. They found that veterans who kill in war are twice as likely to die by suicide than other veterans. And so they think it's important that any clinician working with someone that's been through a situation like killing have help with the moral injury piece. And so they've actually got a 10-step thing that any like psychiatrist or clinician can take and use inside their own therapeutic process. But it's not necessarily a diagnosis protocol. It's like, if you think this person has moral injury, here are some things you can do to help them get through it.
Mm-hmm. What are so some of the
that's a long answer to your sure. question, but I think it's important to know that because it's not a mental health problem, mm-hmm. it isn't that mental health professionals can't be helpful. Mm-hmm.
What if I have had some of those thoughts or ideas floating through my brain, maybe I've said some of those things, what are some of those other symptoms perhaps of moral injury that could indicate that, yeah, maybe this is a problem I have?
Yeah, well, one, you're probably somewhat disconnected from significant relationships because there's a whole emotional world inside you you're not wanting anyone to access. So you're not as emotionally available. You may seem withdrawn to other people. You may seem sort of shut down and cold and not yourself. That's often like, well, they're not acting like themselves. There's something wrong. That's an intuition people often have. It doesn't help to say, hey, is something wrong? It's like, there is, but you're not going to say so. But that's one sign. Another is that you just, like something breaks in you emotionally and you either don't think you know who you are anymore, or you may suddenly not love what you used to love doing. Wendy Dean in her book, If I Betray These, Wendy Dean and Simon Talbert are doctors who study moral injury in medicine, have a book called If I Betray These Words. And she describes her own journey of sort of giving up on medicine, which she had wanted to do since she was a girl, because of a whole series of breakdowns in the healthcare system that made being a doctor almost impossible for her. And Simon Talbot, he's a professor at Harvard Medical School, so he's still doing it, but he recognizes what moral injury is because of his own experiences as a doctor. So it that sense of, I used to love this, but I can't do it anymore. That's a serious break in mission, life, purpose, those kinds of things. And it's not fixable with a vacation. It's not what people call burnout, where you're just too exhausted and you just need rest. Mm-hmm. Because the reason you need the rest, you need time, is the reason you don't want time. Because stuff will come up and you'll have to think about it. And the only way to address moral injury is to go through it. You cannot fix it by avoiding it.
Is
and it's not a Yeah, it's not a fix in the normal sense of it, because you're never going to forget the worst things that ever happened to you.
Is moral injury related to moral failure?
Yes, it can be. It can be that you were so angry at some point you lost it and you did something that is irreversible harm to somebody. Mm-hmm. You gave up on what you needed to do at a moment when you were most needed to do it.
Mm-hmm. Those so kinds in of a, things. In our first responders, so law enforcement, police officers, firefighters, EMTs, even 911, how would that play out perhaps in some of those roles?
Those are often, how would I put it? Those teams train like athletes to do things without thinking. Because in emergency situations, thinking will slow you down. Mm-hmm. And it's not helpful to have to think through everything you do when you are in those kind of dire life or death emergency situations where harm is imminent. So teams work it, that they just work by rote. It's habit. Mm-hmm. And that's really important. But when you're doing things by habit, you're not thinking about them, you're just doing them. And sometimes what you know by habit doesn't work, or it's counterproductive in that situation. And then you feel terrible because you messed it up, because you did something that you were trained to do. And at that moment, that was the wrong thing to do. You didn't diagnose it right or figure it out right or whatever. Like if you're a firefighter, you went through the wrong door and something fell down. They're just things that happen. And or you freeze. You just, for some reason, you freeze. You don't know why. You just didn't do what you need to do. So those are all, I think, ordinary human experiences of emergency situations. And so it's only afterward that I think you start to feel horrible. At the time, you're just doing it. You're just doing it. And so as lots of places do critical incident reports afterwards, right, to figure out where did we go wrong? How can we do better? And sometimes it's in that process that you can begin to wonder about yourself or about a member of your team that you're angry with, because they didn't do the right thing. There are all these complicated things that come afterward where the moral judgments start to kick in. And they have to be processed. Affliction of conscience is not a simple thing to get rid of if you have one. Mm-hmm. I think the only people that might be immune to moral injury are sociopaths. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, it's something that could hit anyone. Life is often chaotic. Reality can be quite chaotic. So we control as much of it as we can, but we can't control a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And so you have to figure out how you're going to make moral sense of it.
Mm-hmm. Has happened perhaps to a person as a child or as a young adult, can that resurface and it can appear mm-hmm. as a moral injury?
Sure, sure. Especially if you were betrayed by an authority figure, especially a parent who harmed you when they should have been protecting and keeping you safe, can make you attentive to not being safe in ways that affect how you're able to behave. Other people may not feel as unsafe conditions. I have a friend who works in San Quentin prison with lifers, and he believes that there's an original trauma in childhood that never got resolved that drives violent behavior in adulthood. Mm. Some kind of fury or anger, just some need for control that's part of it, that's violence. Mm-hmm.
So what's the process, what's involved in healing a moral injury?
Being able to pull up all those difficult and awful feelings in a place where you feel safe doing that, where you're not going to be beaten down more or judged. And so any context in which somebody's going to feel judged, they're not likely to want to process any of it. They won't bring it up. But in a safe environment, and we, in our programs for moral injury, we use what we call peer specialists. That means that they may not be peers in the sense that they're in the very same kinds of jobs as other people, but they're people who understand moral injury because they've processed it themselves. And they're in the group as a member of the group, not as a fixer. So they're there to help the group listen to each other and support each other, because the first step in processing moral injury is to talk about it, especially about the feelings involved, because they're what are driving avoidance behaviors that are often self-destructive avoidance behaviors. But we had people go through our programs and say to us, oh, you know, my therapist, I was being treated for PTSD, so my therapist thought I might find this helpful. And then after the 5 days later, they say, wow, I told things to my group I would never have told my therapist.
Why do you think they were more apt to do that if in a group?
Well,
like
because they were in a group where they thought people would understand what they've been through. Mm. And our groups of first responders are facilitated by people who've worked in some kind of first responder work. Mm-hmm. They may not have been the exact same kind of work, but they understand that sense of mission and life purpose and failure, and have worked on it themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they know it's painful. So we have ways that we try to create a really deep listening environment that's completely non-judgmental, where people can just dump a lot of bad stuff. And everybody goes, oh, yeah, I get you, man. That really, I get that. And just say the feeling is real, the experience, they believe you. They don't say, well, you know, you shouldn't feel that way, or here, let me give you some advice on how to fix it. We don't do that because it isn't fixable. The worst thing that ever happened to you is still going to be the worst thing that ever happened to you. But you don't have to run from it or have it run your life. Mm-hmm. You may never feel good about it when you remember it, but who does? Yeah. I have things I remember. I think, gosh, it's so, that's so terrible. Yeah.
You know, before we started this recording, we were talking about middle school and high school. And my wife told me that, you know, she's at a new middle school this year, and a parent came in, and previously they were angry and they were just talking, you know, just yelling and screaming. And so my wife just listened. And sometimes I think that's what we need, is just someone just to actually hear us and to listen.
Yeah.
Instead of just trying to, well, here's some things that you can do to fix that, you know, try to jump the gun on that. Let's just listen. Let's just stop and listen. And that's so meaningful when someone just does that. Is present and listens.
I get you feel that way. I had a kid in my youth program in the LA school district who'd been in juvenile detention for murder. And I only knew that because somebody told me. He didn't tell me that. But he sat in my small group with other kids, and he never said anything. He just sat there. And I didn't try to push him, because he wasn't disruptive. He was just quiet. He wasn't sitting there with a gloomy cloud, a sullen. He was just very quiet. And at one point in a larger group context, somebody shared how devastated his mother had been when his brother had been killed in some kind of gang thing. And so when we went to our small groups, I noticed that this very quiet guy had been weeping. I could tell his eyes, you know, he just had that look, but he didn't say anything. So everybody else in the group shared something they were thinking about or carrying in relation to the topic of family. Mm-hmm. And near the end, I just looked at him. I've never called on him for days, but I looked at him and I said, you know, you look like you might want to share something. You have anything you'd like to say? And he said, if I were that guy's mother, I'd want to kill me. Hmm. And I just said, thank you so much for sharing that. I really appreciate it. And then we had a closing activity. And then afterward, I pulled him aside and I said, I just want you to know, if whatever you are feeling today, I think is really, really important. And I want to tell you how grateful I am that you said anything in the group. Mm. I mean, I didn't know what else to say to him, but I felt like there was something that changed in him, some shift that happened that day. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea what his fate was after that, but that sense of regret, clearly in what he said, that sense of, oh my God, I did this awful thing, I thought was really, he had hit his moral injury moment. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what it was at that. Sure. I wouldn't have known what to call it, but that pain is his humanity. That's the thing. The moral injury is incredibly painful, but it's at the core of your own goodness and humanity that you feel that way. Mm-hmm. And you can't get to the good part if you can't wade through all that heaviness.
Mm-hmm. How is moral injury connected to or related to spirituality?
Oh, I think it's a soul wound, actually. I mean, if I were to use religious language for it, my background is Buddhist and Christian. My grandfather was a Buddhist priest, but I was raised as a Christian. So I have both sort of in my background, and it's a break in your sense of core self. And a kind of avoidance of going there because you're carrying, that core self is carrying the pain of what you've failed in terms of your core self, or was done to you to wound that core self. That carrying, when you're the victim of a harmful act, the response of outrage and even fury can be pretty deep. It's not just hurt or humiliation or frustration. There's often a kind of feeling wronged. And all of that is because your good self that wants fairness and goodness in the world is really upset that it's been denied you. Mm. And you actually can't find that self to find those things again without unburdening yourself of all those negative feelings, those feelings that are, they're not bad feelings. They're just negative. They're painful feelings. And it's often the case if you're deeply afflicted with moral injury, feelings like joy and hope and curiosity and wonder and anticipation are just impossible for you. Mm-hmm. You can't access that part of yourself.
Mm-hmm. What should I do if I'm experiencing some of that? Or on the other hand, what can I do if I see a family member or a colleague is experiencing some of that?
Well, we have online programs, but I'm not going to go there first. If we are feeling that way or notice other people feeling that way, it's really important to try to find a safe person to talk to. And that may not be a therapist, may not be a professional at all. It may just be a friend. Or even a coworker that you trust. And generally that's a lateral relationship. You don't want to tell your boss these things. but without a person to relieve yourself of those burdens, it's hard for most people. I do know people who've done it with writing, with journaling, to get the feelings down. So there are other individual processes that can happen, but I actually think that the groups we run online are exceedingly helpful because they're small groups of people who are there to try to support each other and facilitators who are there to create that safe and supportive environment. And just unloading and having people believe you is like a gift of grace. And it's also, you get to offer it to other people, which restores your capacity to connect others and empathy for others. And it's a beginning of a process. It isn't, you know, like the it all doesn't tie up at a bow at the end, but it sort of opens the doors for processing those feelings. And often you can come back. I mean, the groups aren't limited to one time only. It's the same format every time. So you're not going to, you know, it's not step one, two, three. It's just the same format every time. It's a little like AA that way. Mm-hmm. But it gives you an opportunity both to unload some of those painful feelings and really unloading them does make it feel better. Mm-hmm. I know that from experience myself. And it makes you, what your experience was, what seemed to you devastatingly painful and shameful, is a gift to other people. Because they get to learn sometimes from your experience or relate to you in a way that helps them be more empathetic. So there's a sort of way that your experience isn't so lonely and awful anymore.
Mm-hmm. How are these groups, these experiences received by some of these first responders that kind of have this tough macho, you know,
that would be all thing. Of your veterans, right, <yeah. laughs> even the women. I mean, it's right. So, it veneer, as it were, mm-hmm. that role, is what keeps you from sharing. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. It's that sense that I shouldn't have to need help. I actually had one of my best friends who was not a first responder. She's a minister, but she was raised in a minister's family, and she was sexually abused by a neighbor when she was four. And she grew up unable to tell her minister family about it, not because they weren't kind and loving, but they were taught that you don't burden other people, you help them.
Mm. Wow. And so, that's probably so similar to what first responders experience, because they are the helpers.
They are the helpers. And so don't bother other people with your burdens. Take care of it yourself or pretend you don't have them. Mm. And it's the worst thing you can do. It's absolutely the worst thing you can do. You're actually, when my friend at 36 went through 6 years of therapy to unburden herself of what had happened to her as a child, she came out so much stronger. Her personality was much more integrated. And there were things that she was able to do that she couldn't do for 30 years, like get angry. Mm. So it took her a long time. I know people who've had their moral injury for decades and they finally deal with it. Mm. And it makes such a difference in their lives.
And it's probably a real sense of relief when someone yep. is set free from that.
Yep. Yeah, it is. And there can be a kind of euphoria almost, mm-hmm. because often there's deep weeping. There's just the feelings finally get expressed so your body can let go of them. It's been holding on to them which causes great stress also. And it's not so good for you. But so that relieves an enormous amount of pressure and stress. And our program, our longer veterans program, we spent the last couple of days after the euphoria helping people find an equilibrium that's not up and down, not pain and euphoria and pain and euphoria, because you can get addicted to that mm-hmm. cycle. But really, now what do I do with this information about myself? How am I going to believe in something again? And how is this belief system going to be able to integrate this thing rather than deny it? Mm-hmm. And I think that is a spiritual quest. Mm. It's about meaning and values and belief. And what you had is meanings, values, and beliefs that didn't work for you because you broke down. That's what moral injury means, is a breakdown in your meaning system. Mm. Now you have to figure out how you're going to have a new one that is more resilient and is stronger. But that is hard. It is really hard work. I don't want to like sugarcoat mm-hmm. how tough it is to deal with moral injury. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of courage.
Sure. So I want to learn more about the groups and how people can get involved with that. But you're working in this kind of field yep. can bring compassion fatigue. How do facilitators keep themselves healthy when they're dealing with all these stories of moral injury?
Well, we always debrief the facilitators so that they don't carry too much, that they're okay. But a lot of them love doing it because they love seeing in an hour, just an hour online, the transformations that happen. So the work itself is for a lot of them its own reward. Mm.
Is it like when they find their purpose, they find purpose and meaning in that work?
And they do.
And that's energizing, right?
Oh, it is. It is. It's very gratifying. I don't do very many of the group facilitations anymore because we have such good facilitators trained and we have plenty of them. But early on, and when we were setting the program up for our own staff in Volunteers of America, we decided to do ministers and open some for chaplains. And so I did a few that were for chaplains. And at the first group I ran, I had a chaplain who didn't say any. They didn't say anything for a long time, and then finally, they were about the last person to speak, and they said, "I haven't spoken because I know if I do, I'm going to start sobbing." And then they started sobbing, and they said that they had spent 9 months helping people die in a hospital, and it was just devastating that. They said this medical staff couldn't do it. And so often the nurses would do that, some of that work. And they wound up being the person who went to all the dying people. And the sadness, just the grief that this person was carrying was huge. And they did sob. And the group just like virtually wrapped their arms around this person and just said, "Oh my God, what's," you know, and each of them had also pretty harrowing stories, but they were so affirming of the work that this person had been doing. And we always end with an affirmation. And I just said, "Say something good about yourself." And so we got to this person and they said, "Well, I guess I was able to get up and go to work this morning." And I, you know, it wasn't much of an affirmation, but it was an affirmation,
in a good direction. Right?
Yeah. So, and I just, at the end of that hour, I just felt so great. I didn't, the burden of the emotional sharing is there, but there's something about the way people feel at the end that, you know, you made some kind of difference. It wasn't life-saving maybe, but it was some positive directional change that happened for pretty much everybody in the group. And that, you know, when you can do that even once, it's a great feeling. And so we have facilities. Oh, I love doing this work. I wouldn't stop because it's hard. I was tired after that hour, but because it's emotionally exhausting, but it's also really, in terms of your heart, very uplifting. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. The we have surveys, you know, people fill out at the end, and not everybody fills them out, but something like 82% of people felt much better afterwards. And most people felt somewhat better. Mm-hmm. Nobody said I felt worse. Mm-hmm. So that's good. That was early. Because it is, we're human beings, we're social animals, connecting at an deep emotional level with people does help make us feel good, even if those emotional connections are powerfully negative. It's the way you go to a memorial service. It's about grief, which is a difficult emotion, but generally you feel better at the end. Mm-hmm. You were with others who shared your grief. They may not have known the person in any of the ways that you knew that person, but the grief is the same feeling for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Can anyone as a first responder get involved in these groups or be a part of that?
Yep. We call our program Resilience Strength Time, and the acronym is REST, R-E-S-T. And so it's a REST program. And so there's a website, REST, R-E-S-T, with the number 4, not F-O-R, but the number 4, restforfirstresponders.com. And when you go to that site, you'll see information about the program. You'll see the link to register for an account. And then after you register for an account, like your email, so they can send you a reminder of your meeting time and stuff, you can see the schedule of when the meetings are. And they vary because of shift work. We have them at different times. And you can sign up for a session. And then you'll get a reminder, I think the day before, the day of. And then you just log in through the same system you registered by. You just show up for your group.
And these are all virtual.
It's not too hard. Yeah, it's not too hard. It's like going to a Zoom meeting or a webinar. Some of you just sign up and go, and you can attend as many meetings as you want. there's no limit.
And I guess then there's a way to, if someone is interested in being a facilitator, there's a process they go through for training and all that.
Yep. There's a training process. And we have such a variety of people who are the facilitators. We've had paramedic, firefighter, police chaplain, a number of healthcare types. I don't think we've had any dispatchers become facilitators, but that's I loved your film because most people don't think of dispatchers as first responders. Right. And they're often in the worst situation where they don't know what happens, right? They don't find out. They've just gone on to the next call and hope to God somebody got there and saved this person, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. What gives you hope for first responders?
My hope for first responders is, that people begin to understand moral injury and how important it is to the people get support for it. But I just think first responders are the good people. They take on some of the hardest work in the society and do it well most of the time. And who does that work except a good person? I don't think sociopaths last long in this kind of work. it takes a sense of mission and life purpose and actually caring about other human beings.
I have to agree with you. So I live in Emmitsburg, Maryland. It's a small community. We have a volunteer fire station here. And last night, middle of the night, I hear the siren going off, and I knew guys and gals were jumping out of bed and running down to the station, jumping on trucks and going out, solving someone's emergency crisis. And I thought, you're right. That takes someone, a good person, to do that.
It does. I mean, who wants to get up in the middle of the night?
I didn't want to get up out of the middle of the night and go jump on a truck.
Or go and face down somebody with a gun who's shooting up a school Right. And in fact, there was so much anger in Uvalde for the police not going, and who knows how all that went down and why they didn't go in. But the community was outraged because we depend on first responders. It's like when people can be angry about police violence, but then when you need the police and they fail, it's even worse in some ways. Right. Because those things could have been prevented, maybe not. But we feel that way. We feel like, well, the first responders have to do their job. And then they often don't get a lot of thanks for it, I have to say. I did love that moment at the beginning of the pandemic in New York where the shift changes. People went out on the streets and banged pots as thank yous.
I think we've forgotten to do that now. Because they're still out there doing stuff.
I know. Well, COVID has become like a habit. It's like it's just around all the time now. And after the first, I think the second wave just defeated everybody.
Yeah, for sure.
The first wave, I felt plucky and people were making funny videos on Zoom and posting them. And there was a lot of silliness as people kept trying to keep cheerful about being stuck at home and all of that. And jokes about toilet paper, whatever. And we started just a little bit that summer to get out a little bit and go traveling. And then that second fall wave hit. And I think it was just too much of a gut punch. I felt it. I certainly felt defeated by it too. And then there was third wave and the fourth. And after the second wave, the third, fourth was like, oh, more of the same. And there's a wave this summer, people hardly paying any attention to it. Right. So we're living with it now, but I think we have not adequately processed what we went through. I think there's a lot of moral injury still out there. The George Floyd murder and some of the other things that happened, polarized people rather than helping people recover.
Sure.
And I think we're stuck there a little bit.
So for first responders, what's an action step? What's one thing that you would recommend someone do if they kind of recognize moral injury in themselves?
If they're feeling that moral queasiness and not like feeling like their best self, and having trouble showing up to work as their best self, I recommend just trying one of our hours. It's a start. And, you know, and if it's helpful, you can come back. You don't have, it's not just a one-off thing. We do have about, I think it's something like 30% of folks return. And it's a way to start processing. We are also working, we're testing this in Florida. We have a 1 day in-person processing program that's longer. It's not just an hour online. It's like a whole day to help our staff process. And we have a lot of first responders on our staff and stuff. So we've been trying it. And so we have a date in September where we're going to go to Florida, and it's going to all be, I think, firefighters. And we're going to try this 1 day in-person thing. If it works, if it's helpful enough, we're going to see if we can start propagating it in first responder communities. Because we have ways to process people for a day and then train people out of that program to become facilitators, so you can have a self-sustaining program in your company or whatever. And you have trusted facilitators. And anytime people get into a state of moral distress, you just run a day's group.
Wow. Well, this is such important work, and there's a lot of work to be done, obviously.
Yeah. The day-long program, we have a name for it right now. We may change it, but it's called Tactical Triage for First Responders.
That's a word that would that would resonate with first responders. So,
yeah, we thought so. It was suggested by a first responder. But it's a mouthful, sure. So we may try to shorten it. Yeah. What I've learned from this work is that the people that tend to be at risk for moral injury are the good people. And I have worked with so many amazing people who experience moral injury and know what it is, and have come out of it amazing in amazing ways. They're doing really great stuff.
Wow. Getting their purpose back and getting back into kind of who they're designed to be.
And helping other people get their purpose back.
Very good.
Well,
Rita, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today. I want to ask you one last thing. What's the next thing for you that's fun? Doing anything fun in the next couple of months?
I have a friend turning 70, and we're all showing up at a winery in California for a party. So I'm taking a vacation and going wine tasting with some friends. That's a regular thing we do together, but this one's special where we're going to actually stay at the winery.
Oh, cool. Very cool. Up in Napa?
Nobody has to drive. Nobody's a designated driver.
That's important.
But the big thing I'm going to do is go to the Olympics next year.
Oh, cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
That's
Paris.
Who doesn't want to go there, right? So,
yeah. Very exactly.
Cool. Yeah. Kind of fun. Well, thank you so much for joining me today on the show. I really appreciate your insights and the work that you're doing. I really, for all the first responders really out there, thank you.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to do this work. It's a real honor.
Thanks, Dr. Brock, for the work you're doing with first responders. I really appreciate it. And thanks to you for listening to the show. I appreciate you. Please leave a review and give it 5 stars if you think it's worth it. And please subscribe to the show. And just a reminder that you can see a video of this content on our Patreon channel. I'll leave a link in the show notes where you can access that information. We want others to discover this content and benefit from it as well. And remember, you are not alone. And if you need someone to talk to and don't know where you can turn, you can dial 988 for help. Until next time, be well, take care of yourself and those around you, and go out and do something great in the world.